Uncle B.S., where were you in 1969? Summer 69? Cutting hair, working as an army recruiter, Woodstock, New York. I'm at the largest Future Farmers of America rally I've ever seen in my life. Trying to talk two Kent State psych majors into joining the National Guard. Like to have them talked into it, too, but some black guitar player kept playing the national anthem so damn loud, I couldn't tell whether they said yes or no. Met that farmer, let him put on that concert over there. He said, I don't mind you using my place, but I didn't know you was going to invite 750,000 people. That first couple of 100,000 didn't bother me so bad, but that last 500,000 scared the hell out of Martell. And they damn sure ain't going to drink out of that lake.
Did you think your plans were secret till you left your office last night and you closed the door behind you? Were you walking in your sleep or were you just too tired to notice all the watchful eyes upon you? There's the man who does the maintenance and the maid who cleans the carpets in the hall. And the guard down in the lobby threw a hidden TV camera sign on. How those little movies habits and your random fancy patterns and how they're looking out the nice guy. And your fully fixed assumption is your secret sally, but then your bones are cool and die. This little birdie told me who was talking to a fly on the wall. So when you think nobody's looking on the eye that passes by you, when you think nobody's listening, I'm the listener. I'm the resistor. Be your next door neighbor, picked up by the escalator, who pretends to be your brother. Or a member of the Lordy, who's a secret Sunday soldier from an underground militia. I might even be your butler or your chauffeur who just opened your car door. I'm the butcher, I'm the baker, I'm your future troublemaker. I'm the guy that used to date your little sister. I'm the sister. And say it isn't what it means, but let me tell you what it means. This means war.
Absolutely, and here is Terrible Tommy in the bunker. Right here in the bunker next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Weapons of Mass Destruction Used Equipment Yard. It is June 5th, 2014. And it's a beautiful day here in north central Indiana. The sun's shining brightly. And the plants and the grass are growing greatly. Yeah. Well, let's get right into the show here. Let's talk about predatory capitalism. How about that? How the world capitalism ravaged the Ukraine's workers. In a recent conversation, a friend asked about the life of workers in the Ukraine. In brief, the workers in the Ukraine, like those in the U.S. cities and around the world, are suffering from massive assaults from the corporatologists and imperialists of the world. But given the current war over Ukraine between the interests of the U.S. European imperialists and the Russian capitalist imperialists, it's important to understand that workers' interests lie with the workers of the world, that we cannot take sides with any imperialist power. U.S. calls for democracy are justifications for increasing the exploitation and oppression of the world's working class, no matter what country you're in. In 1993, a strike wave hit Europe. Airlines workers in France, steel workers in Germany, civil servants in Great Britain struck against wage cuts and privatization. So did tens of thousands of coal miners in the Ukraine, who were joined by workers at the large factories in the industrial centers of eastern Ukraine, who were facing price increases and a rapid decline in living standards as a result of the Ukraine's independence. The strikes in the Ukraine were eventually settled when the government promised to pay raises. But as with the workers in the rest of the world, capitalists in Ukraine were not conceding much to the working class. Instead, they instituted an attack in a new form, a banker-led devaluation of Ukrainian currency that undercut the wages and increased privatization production. In 1993, Viktor Yushchenko, who later became president in 2004 and has since boogied out of town, was appointed head of the newly formed Bank of the Ukraine. He was a main architect of a 1994 agreement between Ukraine and the IMF, U.S. and European capitalism. As a result of that agreement, the price of bread increased overnight by 300%. Electricity prices went up 600%, and transportation prices soared by 900%. Ukrainian grain production was also under assault. The World Bank imposed the first phase of trade liberalization, which lifted tariffs on imported grain, as cheap and U.S. government-subsidized wheat flooded the Ukraine. Its farmers, once the major grain producers of Europe, were forced into bankruptcy. By 2003, Ukrainian per capita income was rising, only to come under attack by the Orange Revolution of 2004, funded by U.S. agencies such as the National Endowment for Democracy and multi-billionaire George Soros' Open Society Institute. The Orange Revolution began another phase of the U.S. effort to reorient Ukraine under U.S. imperialism and away from Russia. And the U.S. favorites in this period were Yulia Tymoshenko, who has made a fortune skimming profits from the sale of Russian natural gas in the Ukraine, and the U.S.-trained banker Yushchenko. The Orange Revolution completely undermined the wages of the workers, who earn some of the lowest wages in the world. According to the German Economic Institute, labor costs in the Ukraine are at 2.50 per hour, that's pounds, well below the average 3.17 pounds in China, 6.46 in Poland, and 21.88 in Spain. An hour of labor in Germany costs 35.66. And that's based on the euro. I'm sorry, I said pound. 1 euro was worth at least $1.38. The economy and workers' living standards were further hit by rising oil and gas prices in 2006 to 2008, then by the global economic crisis of 2008 to 10. What kept workers alive in this period were continuing, though ever smaller, subsidies of commodities such as natural gas, essential for home heating. These subsidies were paid by government borrowing. Ukraine, like Greece, among others, was in debt to the international bankers. In 2010, voters, angry at their losses, rejected the Orange Revolution politicians for Viktor Yanukovych, a politician more closely associated with the social welfare system of pre-1993. But pressed by international finance capital to repay Ukraine's international debt, Yanukovych, like those before him, began negotiations for closer ties to the European Union and the U.S. The deal he negotiated called for massive austerity, like that instituted in Greece. The subsidies that allowed Ukraine's workers to heat their homes, pensions, and other forms of social spending were to be eliminated. In November 2013, fearing he could not sell this deal to his political base, Yanukovych accepted a temporary loan from the Russian imperialists. Ukraine has some of the largest reserves of coal and iron ore in Europe, and is still a major producer and exporter of iron ore to China and India, and steel competing with Germany, France, Russia, and others. The privatization of these industries was rapidly accelerated under Yanukovych. Privatization has led to the closing down of steel plants that need modernization and of many mines. Coal production has fallen by two-thirds since 1991, as imported natural gas replaces coal in plants producing electricity. The result has been a situation in eastern Ukraine where many mine workers work in illegal mines, often run by criminal networks that offer no protections to workers. That is what capitalism has wrought in Ukraine. So that gives you a little bit more up to date. This article was written before the late president took boogied out with a lot of money in his satchel. Don't let people talking you into getting onto the Putin bandwagon, because the working people can't trust any of these kind of people. They have the power, and they're going to go where the power is, and they're either the ruling class, or they're working with the ruling class, or the ruling class party. So don't be swinging from one extreme to the other. One that would be all for everything that's going on in the government in Kiev, or all that's going on in the central government in Russia. Neither side is clean. They don't have clean hands. They all have blood on their hands. Yeah, if you were going to do that, why wouldn't you get all excited if the head of the FBI got out of being an FBI agent and became president? Would you be all gaga about him like a lot of right-wingers are about Putin? Well, here's more on the Eric Holder situation with domestic terrorism. Attorney General Eric Holder said he will reconstitute a long-defunct task force on domestic terrorism to try to expand efforts to stop violent attacks inside the U.S. The task force the Justice Department is reviving was originally launched in the aftermath of the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. It was scheduled to meet on the morning of September 11, 2001, but given the terror attacks of the day, it didn't meet, and the group's work was quickly eclipsed by the response to those attacks and to the effort to defeat al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, and elsewhere. Now, Mr. Holder said in a statement, quote, "We also must concern ourselves with the continued danger we face everywhere from individuals within our own borders who may be motivated by a variety of other causes, from anti-government animus to racial prejudice," unquote. In April, a white supremacist was charged with shooting dead three people in Kansas City area Jewish centers. Incidents such as that one and a shooting that killed six people at the Sikh temple in Wisconsin in 2012 have led officials to consider expanding efforts to detect and prevent hate-based violence, a Justice Department official said. Well, they better be investigating these non-white gangs all over the country, because they're doing 99% of the killing. The Domestic Terrorism Executive Committee will be made up of officials from the Justice Department, the famous but incompetent outfit, and the U.S. Attorney's offices. It aims to help coordinate with local public safety officials around the country, officials said. So, in other words, they're going to be moving as much as possible into local police and sheriffs. So, of course, that's been going on for a long time, but not under this particular group. I know when I first moved in here from California, a federal man dropped by. He had Texas plates on, but he'd been sent out here by the local sheriff. He said, "I just wanted to meet you and say hello, and if you need anything, give me a call." I said, "Thank you. Have a good day," and he was gone. This is, of course, why we need eyes and ears on the inside of the system all over the country. We need people in every community that have eyes and ears into local law enforcement and everything else. The courts, you name it. The economy, you name it. The job scene and everything else. There's something anybody can do instead of sitting there worrying all day about what's happening in Kazakhstan. Check out your own community. Dig in. Find out what's happening. How many feds are going in and out of your police department? And why? Yeah. Wow. A new study's out. Having faith doesn't necessarily mean you're faithful to your spouse. A new survey conducted by Ashley Madison, a dating website for people already in relationships, sought to discover the link between religion and infidelity by asking 105,000 of its members about their religious affiliation. It turns out that 1 in 4 members describe themselves as born-again evangelical Christians, making them the least faithful bunch. Catholics comprise the next largest group at 22.75%, followed by Protestants, 22.7%. People who have faith often use it as an outlet for forgiveness, said Dr. Eric Anderson, a sociologist at the University of Winchester in England. So they're more likely to cheat and less likely to feel guilty. Some of the most faithful SOSs appear to be with those with the least faith, considering only 1.4% of the philandering members identified as atheists. But Hinduism really takes the faith cake. Despite making up 13.8% of the world population, only 0.3% of those surveyed identified as Hindu. Well, let's see here. Evangelist, 25.1%. Protestant, 22.7%. Catholic, 22.75%. Agnostics, 2%. Mormon, 1.6%. Muslim, 1.5%. Jewish, 1.4%. Atheist, 1.4%. Jehovah's Witness, 0.5%. And Hinduism, 0.3%. Well, there you go. That just shows you that we non-believers are a lot more faithful. Aha! That's amazing. Only 1.4% of the atheists polled are cheating, compared to 25.1% of the evangelicals and 22.7% of the Protestant and 22.75% of Catholics. So that adds up to, what does that add up to? Let's see. Adding those all together comes up to 70.3% of the Christians either are into unfaithful activity or believe it's okay, compared to 1.4% of atheists. How about that? That's a hell of a difference. Maybe it's because atheists have a harder time finding women because and men because they don't love the baby Jesus. Well, they don't even recognize the baby Jesus. Thank you.
10 before.
Well, watch out. Here he comes. That crotchety old Mike Malloy, man. He's going to gripe about something.
The Roz in Canada sent me a more state said today, "We come here first and foremost to reaffirm the enduring commitment of the United States to the security of Poland. As NATO allies, we have an Article 5 duty to our collective defense. As president, I've made sure that the United States is upholding that commitment. We're on track with our missile defense program, including interceptor sites here in Poland." Which just never stops, does it? "As we saw this morning, our American aviation detachment here is the first regular presence of U.S. forces in Poland. We continuously rotate additional personnel and aircraft into Poland and the Baltics. And I want to commend Poland for its contributions to the NATO air patrol over the Baltics. Today I'm announcing a new initiative to bolster the security of our NATO allies here in Europe. Under this effort, and with support of Congress, the U.S. will pre-position more equipment in Europe. We will be expanding our exercises and training with allies to increase the readiness of our forces. And I know President Komorowski is a great champion of the efforts to modernize the Polish military. And we welcome the announcement that he just made about an even greater commitment. Money. We'll increase the number of American personnel. Army and Air Force units continuously rotating through allied countries in Central and Eastern Europe. And we will be stepping up our partnerships with friends like Ukraine, Moldova, and Georgia as they provide for their own defense. Money. I'm calling on Congress to approve up to $1 billion to support this effort, which will be a powerful demonstration of America's unshakable commitment to our NATO allies. Poland, to its credit, is a leader in the alliance when it comes to investing in our collective defense. Money. We've seen that again today. Poland's resolve and the initiative I'm proposing today is a reminder that every ally needs to carry their share and truly invest in the capabilities of the alliance that are needed for the future." Jesus Christ, I mean, why not just come right on out, Mr. Obama, and just say, "Hey, we're going to go the extra mile to provoke this former KGB agent who now heads Russia. You know, I'm Barack Obama, I'm the President of the United States, and goddammit, I haven't had a war, you know, that was my making. You know, the Iraq thing, the Afghanistan thing, you know, I did some targeted assassinations with drones, but Jesus Christ, I mean, I'm the first president in a long time that hasn't had a war. How about if I stir something up? You know, 2 years here before I left, I know I will start poking the Russian bear. All that is a regional power anyway, and as somebody said, Russia's just a gas station with a military or something like that. What the hell is wrong with these people? Okay. Jim in Louisiana.
Yeah, what's all that about? What is that about? Here we go again on Poland. Since when is it Poland is in our sphere of interest? Oh, most of the people in Poland went up to work in England anyhow. I don't think there's anybody around down there. They got plenty of room. But you notice the way this black boy, this half-white boy, tosses around, I'll give you $1 billion here and $1 billion there. You know when you're in a dictatorship, you know when you're living in an imperialist country, when the so-called big brother talks and says, "Well, yeah, we're giving them $1 billion. We're gonna protect their ass and see if we can get into another cold war, maybe a hot war with the Ruskies." Yeah, we'll do that. So, anybody ever ask you about that? Do you ever get a call from anybody saying, "What's your opinion?" You know, they could have interactive connections on all the television sets sold now, and all they'd have to do is have yes or no or maybe and have a plebiscite every time there's a major deal goes down. They could have done that a long time ago. They're not going to do that, baby, because they don't give a shit what you think. They don't give a goddamn. And like I say, don't go from the frying pan into the fire, sake, because Obama and all the boys over here are rats. Oh, that must make Putin a good guy. No, the Russians have the same problem with Putin pretty much that we got with these other idiots and Republicrats over here. So don't go running from one side of the boat to the other. Now, what other country in the world would go spastic over a couple of people getting in a car crash? I mean, you know, there's too bad people getting car crashes, but Texas A&M, yeah, they report that a couple of their women basketball players were killed in an automobile wreck. Now, that's major news in this country. The two people that are good at dribbling a basketball down the court and throwing it into a little loop hoop, that's national news. I'm telling you, talk about meaningless dribble. Well, here we go again on the tax struggle, the tax fight. Now, I know I was in on that before I was into the racial struggle back in the day. Sherry Peel Jackson, and I think she's black, is a former IRS agent and certified public accountant who has publicly spoken out about the fact that there is no law that actually requires American citizens to file an income tax return, and that there is also no law that makes anyone liable for paying the federal income tax. Jackson was named as a plaintiff in the We the People Foundation case, which used the First Amendment to petition the government for redress of grievance, stating that the government should have a duty to respond to taxpayers' demands for an explanation about federal income taxes. The argument was rejected by the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit on May 8, 2007. The foundation's appeal to the United States Supreme Court was also rejected on January 7, 2008. Yeah, we've been down this road. There's a whole lot of people have been down this road. October 2007, Jackson was indicted on 4 counts of willful failure to file tax returns. She made the following statement to the jury. Quote, "You've heard the truth of how the Internal Revenue Service, Department of Justice, Federal Reserve, and politicians have perpetuated this smoke and mirrors, dog and pony show on you, the American people, for over 88 years. You have heard of American families devastated by the invasion of privacy and unbridled fear placed upon them through the threats of liens, levies, and even jail time. In my tenure as an IRS agent, I personally saw marriages broken, families torn apart, homes confiscated, and businesses destroyed, all while my colleagues and I were out making unjust demands on the American people without proper authority to do so. Now, you be the judge." The jury took less than 30 minutes to convict her, despite the fact that there's no law mandating the payment of income tax. She was sentenced to serve 4 years in federal prison, serving 5 months of the time in solitary confinement. "That'll fix you. Don't go against Big Brother, boy." Jackson authored 3 books while in jail, and she has since founded two ministries and begun a consulting business. She is considered a hero by many for being willing to stand up to the IRS. Well, there's been a hell of a lot of us have done that. And a hell of a lot of us have went to jail for it, too. Luckily, I escaped that. Let's see if she's commenting here on the stand. Well, I didn't get that cut, but anyhow, you know the drill. Is definitely, it's true what she said and what a lot of other people have said. That doesn't make any difference. The government's in the business of extracting money, and they're going to extract it no matter what you want. It don't make any difference how legal your argument is, and any judge will tell you that. Get that Constitution out of my court. That's not part of the deal. So it's going to take a lot more than the truth to straighten out any kind of income tax problem in this country. It's going to take an upheaval of people. Well, that big row up in Canada with the JDL threatening this MP up there is heating up. Let's tune in here and see if we can get some comment.
Canada, Joshua Blakeney says he's received a threatening message from the far-right militant organization, the Jewish Defense League. The group is banned as a terrorist organization in the US and the EU. Let's listen to Joshua now for the details. He's with us live via Skype from Calgary. Joshua, over to you.
Yes, hi, Homer. Obviously, in recent years, I've been producing reportage from Canada, which is critical of the actions of Canada's ruling neoconservatives, most specifically Canada's subservience to the Zionist regime, the fact that Canada has internalized many Zionist laws and policies and is radically altering this country, seemingly at the behest of Israel. Now, I believe if I was wrong in proffering these arguments, if I was inaccurate, that I would be invited on the Canadian mainstream media and debated and exposed as erroneous and foolish. I think it's because I'm right and accurate in my reportage that the organized Zionist community have seemingly incited their militant wing, the Jewish Defense League, which was described by the FBI, no less, as a violent extremist organization, to attempt to intimidate me into submission. I have to say it's not going to work. I'm going to continue soldiering on with my critical analysis of power and politics in this country. But it speaks to the reality that there appears to be this culture of intolerance establishing itself in this country, a culture of censoriousness crystallizing at the highest levels, where critical viewpoints of Israel and of the organized Jewish community aren't going to be tolerated, even though the organized Jewish community forms such a significant locus of power in this country. When you can't criticize those in power in a country, that's called a dictatorship, and I am not willing to live under a dictatorship. Yes, so I received an aggressive email, a sour email, from an email address purporting to be that of the Jewish Defense League, saying that they're going to use all their resources at their disposal to deal with me, to respond to me. And those resources are quite significant because, of course, in 2009, Jason Kenney, Canada's pro-Zionist Minister of Immigration, barred a British MP, George Galloway, from Canada. And documents that later emerged exposed the fact that he did so seemingly at the behest of the Jewish Defense League. Now, as you said in your introduction, the Jewish Defense League is reportedly proscribed in the European Union and even in the United States. And even its sister organizations, I gather, are proscribed in Israel. But they have a haven here in Canada, which speaks to the reality that Jewish exceptionalism is a state ideology. Now, there are those in my ranks, academicians and legal experts, who say that, you know, I should contact the authorities about this threat, that I should take this very seriously. You know, I tend to side, you know, and be principled about freedom of speech and not wanting to see the police, you know, deciding which emails are legitimate and which are not. But I think this is quite significant. And as I say, I think it vindicates my claim that because we're accurate in our reporting at Press TV, because we're speaking about these censored and controversial subjects which don't make it into the mainstream media in this country, that there's going to be an attempt to silence me and to quash any discourse that I'm proffering and any analyses that I'm advancing.
So, Joshua, just before we let you go, do you in any way feel endangered now as a result of getting this message? And have you heard of similar instances for other journalists?
Well, I mean, people can Google the track record of the Jewish Defense League. You know, they're quite litigious, so I have to be careful what I accuse them of. But, for example, in 1995, there was a German historian based in Toronto. His house blew up. There was a bombing of his house. The Jewish Defense League denied involvement. And according to the Toronto Star, they did accuse the Jewish Defense League of having ties to the group that undertook that operation. So I shouldn't take this lightly. But as I say, I don't think people should silence their viewpoints because of the intolerance that appears to be ingrained among certain groups. Obviously, the blood of the Palestinians, the prevention of the destruction, the attempted destruction of Iranian society through sanctions and so on, is far more important than trying to make my life more easy. But certainly this could be significant. It's just an interesting fact, I think, that the Jewish Defense League has a safe haven in this country when it's obviously banned in other countries. And it speaks to the reality that Canada's ruling neoconservatives are trying to be more Israeli than the Israelis themselves. And, you know, the fact that this organization exists in Canada is surprising, but the fact that it seems that there are main, politicians in the cabinet in Canada's parliament who lend their ears to this group is itself even more astounding. So this could be highly significant, but, you know, we have to in life decide whether we're going to go along with the propagandistic lies of the journalistic and political establishment or whether we're going to try and speak the truth. And I'm very committed to living in a Canadian society that has unfettered free speech, that has a dialogue, that's able to resolve issues and is able to criticize those in power. And this intolerance, this censorious impulse that we see emanating from Zionist organizations, we can't go along with that, unfortunately.
So that's the fight there in Canada. One politician's putting up a fight against the Jewish Defense League. I hope he doesn't get his house blown up. Boy, they're still going on and on about old Craig Cobb and the lease situation, and it gets wilder all the time, man. They're putting out documentaries on there. You would think it was Hans Guderian and his massive armored divisions that went into Leith and did all this. Oh, it's horrible. It's unbelievable, the exaggeration. And that's why you can't leave them control the situation. Better off to just leave them stewing their own crap and worry about lone wolves. I'm sure they'll have more time to worry about lone wolves. In fact, they're going to have their celebration up there in Leith, and I put it out this morning that I'd like to dedicate probably my lot there, my wonderful lot in downtown Leith, to the struggle against fracking and tar sand, dirty oil coming down from Alberta, and the whole environmental attack that's going on all over the country so a few people can become massively rich. So I think that we may be putting some kind of a headquarters there for that kind of information, because we're involved in the environmental struggle along with our own racial struggle. Well, let's check on the latest deal on this corruption in the VA and the scam that's going on there that's hurting veterans who were, number one, hurt by being sent overseas to these crazy-ass corporate wars, but then when they return, get crapped on.
It's becoming more and more clear the problems at the Department of Veterans Affairs can't be blamed on money. Just in the last 5 years, about $136 billion went to pay salaries of VA employees, and another $282 million went strictly to bonuses. The practice overall is one the chairman of the House Veterans Affairs Committee finds disturbing.
Look, you shouldn't get a bonus for doing your job. And that's what apparently VA does. If somebody just does the minimum and hits the targets, they get a bonus. In the private sector, you get to keep your job.
Perhaps the most shocking part about the bonuses is what isn't being funded. More doctors and nurses to care for veterans, often forced to wait more than 100 days. Not to mention dozens of other services and resources cut completely.
In the Memphis VA, while they're cutting services to our veterans, they eliminated the aqua therapy pool, which was really popular and necessary for rehabilitative services because they cited a lack of funding. Yet, over the course of the last 3 years, $1 million worth of bonuses were paid out to the employees of the Memphis VA.
When it comes to accountability, one of the first rules is to simply follow the money. Now we're learning even more examples of how that money isn't leading to veterans. Here's a look at the five cities where VA employees earn the highest salaries and also how much they receive in bonuses. The number one nation, Washington, D.C., where much of that, according to OpenTheBooks.com, goes to top executives and VA lawyers.
The bureaucracy is serving the bureaucracy of the VA, and they've lost the sight of their mission, and that's to give health care to veterans.
He says it's a sign that perhaps that mission needs its own round of treatment and some major rehabilitation. I'm Christine Frizzell
Fox 45 News.
Well, it sounds to me like the man that was the head of that Asian hybrid should be going to prison, not being just let go, not being just fired, considering this outlandish, tremendous waste of money that didn't ever really get to the veterans. He should go to the slammer. But nobody ever goes to the slammer in this country. At the top, only people at the bottom. Now, thanks to openbooks.com, I'm sending you out a list of all the money that the VA offices all over the country have blown. So read it over and see what they've done in your state and your town. Well, here's another guy that dared speak his mind, whether you like it or not. He talked about his dislike for homosexuals, and immediately the whole roof caves in. He was on the Tonight Show, and listen to this. Wait a minute.
To our show, I appreciate you being here. We always like you as a guest.
I'm thrilled to be here, and I'd actually like to address something, if that's okay, to your audience.
I heard about this. Now, this you something happened over the weekend. You got in a lot of trouble.
Yeah. So unfortunately, this isn't a joke. So this weekend, I was out with some friends, and there was a paparazzi guy, and he was antagonizing me and calling me names, attacking me personally and my family personally. And I was genuinely hurt by this and made angry by this. And in response, I wanted to hurt him back. And I said the most hurtful word that I could think of at that moment. And, you know, I didn't mean this in the sense of the word. You know, I didn't mean it in a homophobic way. And I think that that doesn't matter. You know, how you mean things doesn't matter. Words have weight and meaning. And the word I chose was grotesque. And
he called him a faggot.
No one deserves to say or hear words like that.
Kiss ass. And, kiss ass.
You know, I've been a supporter of the LGBTQ community my entire life. And I completely let the members of that community and everybody else down when I used a word like that.
Yeah.
And
oh my
heart's broken. And I genuinely am deeply sorry to anyone who's ever been affected by that term in their life. And I'm sorry, and I don't deserve or expect your forgiveness. But what I ask is that at home, if you're watching this, and you're a young person especially, if someone says something that hurts you or angers you,
yeah,
use me as an example of what not to do.
Okay.
And don't respond with hatred or anger.
You chicken shit.
Because you're just adding more ugliness to the world.
You big fat chicken shit.
Again, I'm so sorry.
I
hope you lose your job.
Being sincere and saying that.
Yeah. I know I'm usually funny and stuff, but this wasn't funny. It was stupid. And
I hope you lose your job.
I'm going to get for it. You know?
Yeah. Well, no. That's good that you came out and you came out and no, I didn't mean that.
Can you believe it? People, these guys that get a good job like that, to get a contract with some TV show or movie or something, and if they say one little thing off cuff, well, they'll spend the next 6 months kissing ass. Yeah, what a bunch of cowards. Whatever happened to the, I said it, I meant it, and I'm glad, and I ain't taking nothing back. Eat your heart out. If I don't like homosexuals and I want to say so, I'm going to say so. That's free speech. If, you know, in the old days, if you'd have said, well, I like homosexuals, that would have got you in more trouble than this. However, it's not funny when they use this kind of attack to come down on people like the roof falls in just to shut you up. That's what it's all about. Don't ever give your opinion again unless it goes along with the media opinion, the ruling class opinion, whatever it is. Because if you don't listen to us and you don't kiss our ass, we will destroy you. Well, Jim Hightower says that the fast food corporations are stealing off their workers. Well, I surely wouldn't doubt that. Let's see what he's got to say.
No matter how small the haul, a thief is a thief, right? If a poverty wage fast food worker sneaks out a couple of burgers to take home to the kids, the bosses yell, "Thief!" But what do you call it when the bosses steal from those same workers? How about outrageous, disgusting, or simply unbelievable? Well, believe it or not, it's happening every day in multiple ways, and not by a few bad apples, but in what has become routine corporate practice by McDonald's, Burger King, Domino's, and other hugely profitable chains. Technically, it's called wage theft, and it involves such slick-fingered moves as erasing hours from employee time cards, requiring off-the-clock work, not paying for overtime hours, refusing to reimburse workers for gas they bought while making deliveries, or inventing uniform fees and other deductions that illegally drop pay below the minimum wage. Come on, isn't it shameful enough that these global behemoths pay rock-bottom wages without them circling back like low-life pickpockets steal from their own employees? This is not just corporate thievery, it's thuggery. How low can fast food greed go? So low that the top bosses at headquarters play a sleazy game of hide-and-seek, pretending that they have nothing to do with this rip-off. Personnel practices, they airily claim, are left to local franchisees who are, quote, independent business owners. Bovine excrement. Corporate Central dictates how much mustard each franchise can put on a bun. So to think that it doesn't monitor every dime in payroll is a ludicrous lie. This is Jim Hightower saying, in a recent survey of fast food workers, 9 out of 10 said they have had wages stolen by their bosses. This thievery has become business as usual, and it's worse than shameful. It's slimy. For more information, go to National Employment Law Project at NELP.org.
Well, what I suggest is you people out there is download, record this, and burn some CDs and hand them out around your town to the fast food workers. Yeah, just have a few of those in your car, and when you go in, if you go in to have a hamburger or whatever, just hand a CD to the workers and get the word out there so that they'll begin to think about the horrible word of strike. Around where I'm at, they're almost all white, these young people working in these places. Well, here's something out of courtnews.com. Should be interesting. The New York Times reporter Charlie Savage is trying to wrest documents about the U.S. Secret Surveillance Court in his latest FOIA lawsuit against the Department of Justice. Savage seeks documents that he described in his recent article, quote, "How a Court Secretly Evolved Extending U.S. Spies' Reach," unquote, which he co-wrote with documentary filmmaker Laura Poitras. Featuring secret documents leaked by NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, the story traced how a court designed to prevent U.S. intelligence agencies from trampling on the privacy of U.S. citizens came to approve mass surveillance after September 11, 2001 attacks. In 1978, Congress passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act in the wake of the Nixon administration abuse of power, which included using the U.S. intelligence apparatus to spy on Martin Luther King and other civil rights leaders. Oh, well, yeah. Boy, that's bad. The legislation tasked the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, or FISC, with granting or denying wiretap orders for national security matters. Now, I'll bet you Martin Luther King's phone was tapped after he came out against the Vietnam War. You want to bet? I don't think so before. From its inception, the FISC has been cloaked in a high degree of secrecy, New York Times attorney David McCraw wrote in Savage's 8-page complaint. consistent with the judicial practices in other courts for simple yes or no decisions about wiretap and search orders in ongoing investigations. FISC proceedings are not publicly noticed, and only government lawyers are permitted to appear in the court without adversarial process. So that's a little bit of that skullduggery that's still going on, but thanks to our hero, Mr. Snowden, it's coming out more and more. Well, here's a woman that got upset with this black fellow that scared her kids, so she told him off. And he's taping the whole thing. Yeah.
I have her on tape calling me racist comments, called me a nigger in front of her kids.
You scared my children.
Well, it's cameras out here. And we'll see. Because we'll definitely be filing charges. Please call the cops.
Please
thank
do.
You. Please. Got everything on tape. Your voice, too.
It's not
calling
illegal.
Me a nigger.
Nigger's
that's
not
how
illegal.
You feel.
Hey, black boy. Nigger's not illegal.
You might as well take care of your kids. Don't worry about me.
I know where my kids are.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I guess she's calling
please
the cops.
Do.
That's a mistake. She shouldn't call the cops. Don't ever call the cops on a deal like this. He thinks it's illegal to call
that's
somebody
okay, buddy.
Call somebody a nigger.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, here you go again. He's all upset, man. So he's videotaping this lady.
Racism alive and well. Amazing.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Really? You called me a nigger, and I just want to sit back, huh? You called me a nigger, I just want to sit back. By starting my car. By starting my car. Amazing.
She's telling him off. He's
wow, you got your kids cursing at me too, huh?
Don't talk to my kids.
Wow, this is amazing.
Do not talk to my kids.
Okay.
Hello? Talk to this fucking nigga
not...
right now. I am telling you, he's video recording me. He scared the shit out of Anthony. He's got his car. He wanted to run his mouth talking about me being his fancy mother. Fucking say
really?
Something.
Really? I said
down.
That.
He's got me on videotape, and I'm still flipping the fuck out.
You called me a nigger.
I called you a nigger. You're a nigger. Nasty. Fucking nigger.
Okay. You might want to get
because
your...
he's a fucking loser. That's why he thinks he's gonna get something out of it.
Oh no wonder. I don't sue people.
Oh, he knows the cops. How many cops have I stripped for? You ain't getting far, bitch.
Okay.
Tell him, dude. You will fucking kill him. Don't even fucking. I'm telling you right
that's
now.
That's very very good.
I will fucking yank his ass on the car.
Please do.
I don't know. What? Because he wants to put it on YouTube, try and act hard because I called him a racist because he's a racist, ignorant nigger.
She's really telling.
Oh, what? He's a racist fucking nigger?
Yeah.
All right, you're done. My lawyer's involved.
Good. Thanks.
Stay here. My husband's coming.
Okay, sure.
She told him off, and the kids told him off. I'll send this along
get
to you.
Get the video off my kids now, or I will fucking break it. I'm gonna whip my coffee at him
go
if
ahead.
He does not stop fucking.
He put up his window and locked the door. Brave Negro. This is hilarious. I'll see if I can send this along to you. Well, I think I shared with you yesterday my feelings about this trooper that walked away from his so-called post of occupation of a country we shouldn't have been into at all. So before you start calling people names and everything and, you know, and insults and all that kind of stuff, say, look, none of the guys should be over there at all. This corporate military industrial complex, capitalista minions occupying other countries is absolutely naturally illegal. And if these troops can get out of there without being killed, that's good. But if I was an Afghan, or if I was an Iraqi and American troops were occupying my country, I'd kill as many as I could kill. That doesn't mean I want these guys to die. It means I want them to stay home and quit doing this. Every time the goddamn president and his corporate buddies bang on the pan, they come running. Oh, I want to fight for my country. I'm going to save my country. What a bunch of hogwash bullshit. Don't ever do it. Don't join up. If you got an enemy, that enemy is right here. And it's centered in Washington, D.C. and Wall Street. And to a lesser degree, your state capitals. So don't let them talk you into this crap. And then you go over there and you're getting shot at, you're getting shit at, and everything else. And you're getting crap from your officers and everything else. And you walk off and they say, oh, you're a traitor. You're a traitor. Well, God, you know, I'm not a believer in God, but anyhow, God bless people who walk away from the military-industrial complex and say, fuck you. What he should have done, this one that just did this, was he should have just went on leave and walked off, or got leave and came back to the United States and walked over into Canada or someplace or whatever, you know. Unfortunately, I think they have converted into an Islamic brain set, and of course we cannot have anything really to do with the race mixing religion of Islam. That doesn't mean that we don't have sympathies for some of their problems in their own country, and if they'd stay there, that's all right. You run Afghanistan, we'll run the United States. But don't come over here flooding our country like you're doing in Europe and Britain and all over the place, because that puts us in a very bad mood about you. That's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Freya's Day. She-Wolf Day in the bunker tomorrow. We'll close out with a song. How about that? And remember, the five words, I have nothing to say, and also, shut up. Don't talk to cops. Don't let them interrogate you. Stand mute.
Ride this train up and down and across a strange, wonderful land. It's almost like a fairyland when you think about it. You go through places with names like Tuscaloosa, Kokomo, Muskogee, Oshkosh, Saginaw, Eureka, Bandera, Battle Creek, Sioux City, Chattanooga, Hattiesburg, Lynchburg, and Bald Knob, Arkansas. You see, I'm a million different people from all over the world, and I've been coming to this country for hundreds of years. This was the promised land for me. But let's not forget that when I came here, Indians' hearts must have been full of music, for they left names with me that seemed the same. Names like at the heart and muscle of this land, a few things you don't read in books, things that aren't taught in school. Now, you take this little town we're going through here. This is Beach Creek, Kentucky. And right down there in the valley, that's where our house used to be. It was a little shotgun shack with a spring out the back and a smokehouse and another little bitty house, and that's about all. My pa was a coal miner like most everybody in Muhlenberg County. Worked in the mines all his life. I guess he didn't have much ambition to do anything else, because they say coal mining kind of gets in your blood. Matter of fact, pa said if they ever drained the blood out of him, it'd be blacker than blackstrap molasses. When I was a kid, I used to set the fireplace there with Ma, and we'd wait on Pa to get in from the mine, and we'd sure get anxious if he was ever late. Ma'd rock back and forth and watch the clock, listening to Pa to hit the front porch. Then he'd come in, nothing clean but the whites of his eyes, and he'd reach for that lasso and start scrubbing. And I'd stand back and watch him and say to myself, boy, I'll be glad when I get big enough to work in the mines. My pappy said when I was 17, you're 6 feet tall and your face is clean, and it don't look right for a boy that old to not make a living loading coal. Loading coal, loading coal. I'm a double first cousin to a dad blame old. Never get rich for to save my soul in 41 years of loading coal. Loading coal. Ain't never got acquainted with a dollar bill, and I don't ever reckon that I ever will. A dollar ain't made for a feller, I'm told, that scoops up a living loading coal. Loading coal, loading coal. I'm a double first cousin to a dat-blame mole. Never get rich for to save my soul in 40-11 years of loading coal. Loading coal. I cussed everything in the mining camp, from my shovel and my pick to my carbide lamp. But I know mighty well, till I grow old, I'll still be a cussin' but loadin' coal. Loadin' coal, loadin' coal. I'm a double first cousin to a dat-blame mole. Never get rich for to save my soul in 40-11 years of loadin' coal. Loadin' coal. Just as well as coal is black. One of these days the mines will strike, and I'll sit around starving till I'm finally told there's a nickel more a ton for loading coal. Loading coal, loading coal. I'm a double first cousin to a dat-blame mole. Never get rich for to save my soul in 40-11 years of loading coal. Loading coal.